Blog Talk Radio.
No, no, it's some other people.
Blog Talk Radio.
And no matter where you've been or where you might currently find yourself, it's not over. When God is in it, there is no limit. New breed.
Yeah.
everyone. I'm Gary Hines, your host. Welcome, Center Stage. We'd like to begin tonight by expressing our condolences to the families and friends of those killed in Newton, Connecticut school shooting today. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all that were affected by that senseless tragedy, which again leaves us with more questions than answers. However, tonight we're talking about another shooting that took place in Kansas City on December 1st that left Cassandra Perkins and Javon Belcher dead. Javon Belcher killed Cassandra Perkins and then himself in a murder-suicide. That's the show that we covered last week. Tonight's show is a follow-up to that show. However, tonight we like to focus on domestic violence. See, and one in every four women will experience domestic violence in their lifetime, and 85% in every, 85% of all domestic violence victims are women. There are 16,800 homicides and 2.2 million medically treated injuries due to intimate partner violence annually. That's what we're talking about this tonight, y'all, and I've got a great panel lined up to help us better understand domestic abuse and how to escape it safely. But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. My guest tonight, y'all, let's begin with Diana Franzetti. She's Executive Director of Client Services at Brighter Tomorrows. Also, we have Brandi Smith. She's Director of Client Services at Brighter Tomorrows. Their website is www.brightertomorrows.net. Also, we have Rita Smith. She's Executive Director for the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Their website is www.ncadv.org. And last but not least, we have attorney Anna Valentini, Esquire. She's with the Valentini Law Offices in the New York area. Anna Valentini has successfully represented many female and male domestic violence survivors before the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services and Immigration Courts. Mrs. Valentina has given presentations at international conferences on immigration law and human rights. I'd like to say good evening to my guest and welcome Center Stage.
Hi there.
Good evening. Listen, because all of us are ladies tonight, when you chime in, be sure to announce who you are so that when they say this later, everyone will know who was speaking at the time. Let's begin by talking about what exactly domestic violence is, because for someone who may be suffering from domestic violence, they may not even know that's their situation. So let's begin with explaining and defining exactly what domestic violence is. Diana, we'll start with you. Tell us what or define for us domestic violence.
Hi, yes, this is Diana, and thanks for having us on. We're really honored to be here. Well, domestic violence is a power play. It is control and power, and the abuser feels that they must hold sway over their the person that they're abusing, and generally there's children involved also who either see it or just experience it in the home. So it can really be physical, emotional, financial, just mental abuse. It can be all of that, a combination of any and all of those particular aspects of abuse.
Okay. Let's see, Brandi, can you tell us, are there other titles for domestic violence?
Well, like the one you mentioned earlier, intimate partner violence, family violence. So it's not just with your partner. You can have violence amongst family members, siblings, mother and children, father and children. You can have violence between same-sex relationships. Probably the least understood one for a lot of people. So there are different forms of violence, like Diana said, and different dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Rita Smith, I went to your website and saw a press release that you put out about domestic violence. Can you tell us a little bit about that press release you put out on domestic violence?
Yeah, it was submitted right after Javon Belcher murdered Cassandra Perkins in Kansas City. And it was really an open invitation to the NFL to allow us to partner with them to help them understand the issue better, but also to help them influence enormous numbers of fans that they have that could really get the word out and help us spread information in a way that we would not have the capability to do without the kind of visibility they could bring. And part of what I wanted to focus on was the fact that most men are not violent, most NFL players are not violent, but what everybody seems to put their attention on are the ones who are violent, the ones who do horrible things. And I think we really need to reform the way that we work with men and get really strong, caring, good men to stand up and start to change the norm. So I see that the NFL has the capacity to do that, and I believe that that most men, if they knew the kind of influence they could have and that just speaking up and not staying silent anymore might actually make their communities and their families safer, I believe they would come to the table and help. So that's really, I think, what the focus of that press release was about.
Yeah. Attorney Valentina, I went to your website, and you were talking about the Violence Against Women's Act. Can you tell us how that particular act, they're looking to revise that? What is the revision going to include?
You mean their reauthorization of the act?
Yes.
Right. Well, I'm not really 100% familiar with the revisions. I can tell you what it is at the current stages.
Okay.
So currently I-360, it's a petition that survivors of domestic violence can file regardless of their frequently illegal immigration status. Mm-hmm. And basically this petition allows them a path to lawful permanent residency, and that's very important because alien survivors of domestic violence unfortunately tend not to disclose this abuse that's going on at home just because of the fear of being deported. So this I-360 petition, VAVA application is extremely important, especially pertaining to immigrant survivors of domestic violence, both male and female.
And I understand your office works very closely with victims of domestic abuse with helping them file a petition for that I-360, correct?
Correct.
Okay. That's what I thought. Diana, that Violence Against Women's Act, isn't that dealing with including immigrants and also including lesbians and gays in that new act? Or the revision on that particular, or the revision they're trying to get passed on that act?
I think so, yes. I think you're correct on that.
Carrie, I could give you some more specifics about that if you'd like it.
Sure.
It's one of the things that the National Coalition has been working on for 2 years in with Congress with a whole group of other national advocates on this issue. And every 5 years it has to be reauthorized. So every 5 years we have to go in and get it approved again. And every 5 years since 1994 we have improved the previous version. So while the bill was being implemented in the field, programs like the one that Diana represents would give us feedback about what's working and what's not working. Lawyers who work with immigrant victims like the other guest, and I'm sorry I forgot her name, it gives us feedback about what kinds of changes might be helpful. And so the three provisions that seem to have been the most troublesome for the House leadership, the Senate passed a bipartisan bill in April, 68-31, and that bill was a really good bill. It included provisions, improved provisions for immigrant victims. It included actually specifying the GLBT community so that gay men, for instance, could access services because they're not women. They, you know, the money was limited at that point. So it was expanding services to make sure that those within the GLBT community could be protected. And then one of the most important provisions as well was providing extended provisions for tribal Native members, women who are assaulted on reservations by non-Natives. Right now, tribal courts cannot prosecute non-Natives, no matter what they've done on reservations, and the federal prosecutors simply can't keep up with the number of crimes that are happening. So for domestic violence and sexual assault, on Native women on reservations, the tribal courts were going to be allowed to actually prosecute those men while providing their constitutional protections. So those three pieces seemed to be a sticking point when it got to the House. They passed a completely different version. It got stalled. It is very unlikely at this point that they're going to get their act together and get it passed before the end of the year, which is quite frustrating, and it means the funding will be delayed. It means we'll have to start from the beginning when the 113th Congress comes in. I just, you know, it's just mind-boggling why this bill that has been completely bipartisan up to now is sticking at this point. It makes no sense.
You know, what's amazing is I read some statistic, and I'm just trying to find that Native Americans, for some reason, suffer from domestic violence more often than most, and I'm trying to find my notes on that. And I was surprised by that. Is there any certain reason for that? Is that, Attorney Valentini, is that because is there a specific reason for that?
Well, I worked with immigrant survivors of domestic violence, so I'm not really familiar with the statistics that you are mentioning.
Okay, gotcha. One thing I found in researching for this show is that domestic violence is one of the most chronically unreported crimes. Does anybody have a reason why that happens? I mean, is it because of fear? Or why do you suppose is the most chronically underreported?
It's Brandy, Director of Client Services.
Okay.
It's underreported because the women are afraid. Sometimes they don't trust law enforcement. If they called and they got arrested or, you know, then sometimes that creates mistrust. That's not always the case. I don't want you to seem like the police are always arresting our victims. That's not always the case. But what we'll find is he'll call the police really quickly, and she'll go many, many, many times without ever calling on him. And the one time she fights back or gets physical with him, then the police get called out. Survivors sometimes don't present well when police come on because, I mean, if someone just called you a really bad name and is slapping you around, you're probably not calm. And so sometimes that happens. It's a fear. They don't want him to get arrested. We mentioned financial abuse. If he is the sole provider, he's set it up that way, then she's afraid that, you know, how is she going to feed the kids? How are they going to take care of getting them to school? You know, just lots of things that people don't always think about. When, you know, they think, oh, she should just leave. Well, you need to think about what are all those reasons that keep her in that relationship. Sometimes they can't see past the fear.
And this is Diana. Also, they're fearful that if the police do take care of the abuser, then there's many times his family will, in effect, step in and start abusing her or stalk her or track her and the kids and so it just becomes a many-pronged dilemma for them. And when I give talks, I always talk to, always mention, you know, people, I say the statistic is it usually takes about 7 times for someone to leave their abuser. That's because when they try to leave is when they're at the greatest danger of being severely injured or even killed, when they're actually trying to leave. So imagine leaving your home this morning and you don't have a checkbook, you don't have a credit card, and you haven't been allowed to have any money. You're going to walk out with what you have in your purse, and you're taking 2 little children along with you. What are you going to do? I mean, it is very, you can't just could you just get up and walk out of your house this morning and never come back and not have anything and not have any resources? No. So when you layer in domestic violence and you add in 2, 3, 1 children, 5 children, whatever, it just compounds the whole situation, and it takes a long, long time to do safety planning.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about all that tonight, y'all. We're going to talk about safety planning, what you need to do in terms of having a bag packed, you know, if your situation is one of those. We're going to talk about all of that. But before we move on, I want to mention Brandy and Diana are out of the Texas area where I am right now. And in Texas, if the police are called in a domestic situation, doesn't the law say somebody's got to go to jail?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because if you're in a situation where you're afraid he's going to beat you some more if he gets out of jail, you're probably subject to say it was me.
Yeah.
And go to jail rather than him go to jail, and then he gets out in 24 hours and then it starts all over again, and this time worse.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that's true for every single police department, because different departments have their own, you know, their own protocol.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, if there's a pattern of abuse and they've been called out, then, and somebody's bleeding or hurting or whatever, then they're probably taking someone to jail. I know that our police departments are very supportive. They work really hard with our to keep our people safe.
And, you know, another thing about domestic violence, because so many situations in which police are called out on a domestic violence situation, somebody ends up getting killed. A lot of times it's even the police officer. So have police changed the way that they handle domestic violence calls? Have they, anybody?
I don't know. It is very dangerous for them. There is a certain way they handle the situation. You know, they kind of separate the two parties. They don't want to turn their back towards anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Anybody want to expand on that?
Well, I can. This is Rita. Certainly they have changed over the last 30 years in how they've dealt with these with these cases. They certainly have changed some of their strategies. And one of the things the Violence Against Women Act did was fund training for police and other law enforcement personnel. So that has been significantly helpful in getting them to understand the dynamics and not just walk the guy around the block, cool him off, and leave her at his mercy, because that's what they used to do. And so most states now have a probable cause arrest, where if it looks like Brandy was mentioning that there's some, you know, some damage or someone's hurt, that they can, in fact, arrest. But I do think that, the issue is that it's an ongoing training. There are new police coming in all the time, new law enforcement officers coming in all the time. You have to train them. A great deal depends on the administration, the leadership of the administration of that police or law enforcement department, what their belief is around whether or not this is an important call, and whether or not it's handled appropriately and consistently every time. So the chief or the sheriff is critical and key, and I'm sure that, you know, really good domestic violence programs have strong relationships with those leaderships in law enforcement. But it's an ongoing process, and you have to keep working at it, because new people come in and you have to keep training.
It is. This is Diana. Brighter Tomorrows is very lucky, because we have the police chiefs of Irving and Grand Prairie, where we have both of our shelters on our board. So we have a great, we can call them, I can call them at any time if we have any issues, if any questions or anything with any clients who might be in danger. So I would encourage anybody that's listening to work with their local domestic violence and support it and encourage the police to support those centers, those shelters.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I found out in researching for this show, in 70 to 80% of intimate partner homicides, no matter which partner was killed, the man physically abused the woman before the murder. That was like, wow, those numbers, that's really high numbers, 70 to 80%. Looking back at the Javon Belcher and Cassandra Perkins' murder-suicide, we don't know because there hasn't been any information to date that I've come across, y'all, that said he had physically abused her before. But, you know, in looking at this 70 to 80%, you know, it just makes you wonder why are the warning signs not clearer before it gets to this point?
Well, this is Brandy. I can talk a little bit about that. You know, I've worked for Brothers Mars for about 8 years now,
mm-hmm.
and my knowledge or just my understanding of how complex this issue is keeps growing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I don't think people really understand is that they're not, most of the time the guys are not like raging maniacs all the time. And there are signs, but they start out very subtle. And it's kind of stuff that women notice, or maybe it gives them a sense of like, oh, that didn't feel good, or I don't understand that, but because they are afraid to offend or don't want to rock the relationship, they don't say anything. So it's really educating younger kids and younger women and men about what it means to have a relationship that does confront those issues. Like, it's not okay for you to isolate me and I'm telling you, it starts off very, very subtle, and you dismiss it until it gets to a bigger issue.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, does that make sense to you
it
how
does.
That happened?
It does. You know, but you know, I'm a big Dr. Phil fan, and one thing Dr. Phil says repeatedly on his show is the best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. So that said, if someone hits you once, twice, aren't they likely to continue to hit you?
Yes. I mean, it will happen. It probably will happen again. But, you know, I love that example. Okay, he hits you once out of, let's say, 6 months.
Mm.
Well, they're not looking at the one time he hit her. They're looking at all the other 6 months of the day that he held her hand, that they went to the movies, that they talked. She's holding on to the side of him that she believes in, the side of him that she loves, that she fell in love with and has companionship with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wants to think, she might want to minimize the abuse, and that's exactly what he does. He minimizes, you know, oh, I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't talked back to me. You know, I know that you mentioned, I listened to the Javon Belcher show that you did last week, and you know, it's his belief system. He said, you can't talk to me like that. He really believes that. So it's confronting those belief systems and then also kind of helping her understand that, you know, even though all those great things happened, he's starting to show signs of abuse.
Mm. You know, Attorney Valentina, I noticed on your website where you were talking about helping people that were immigrants and how often people will come over here and their partner is a permanent resident alien or a citizen and they will suffer from abuse and be afraid to leave. Expound on that. They're afraid to leave for what reason?
Right. So they're afraid to leave because they don't know what's going to happen to them once they leave. They are not sure how to communicate to law enforcement. Sometimes they don't speak the language. Sometimes it's just not in their culture to seek help from law enforcement. Sometimes it's not in their culture to admit to others that, you know, my spouse hit me or my spouse is emotionally abusing me. So there are a lot of factors that influence their decision not to report their abuse and not even to talk about it, not to open up about it.
So they may deal with it without doing what someone who's a citizen may do, maybe like filing a restraining order. That may be something they would be afraid to do because they don't feel like the law will protect them. Is that what that is?
Exactly. Some of them come from underdeveloped countries, and they just grew up not trusting law enforcement, not knowing that law enforcement is actually there to protect them. So because of those cultural barriers, they don't even think about reporting this abuse because
they have no guarantee that law enforcement is going to protect them, or to that matter, if anybody is going to protect them.
And they probably don't even have any knowledge of a restraining order or protective order. You know, they may not even know that that's a possibility.
They don't even have that concept.
But there is some protection under the law with this I-360 petition that you talk about helping them file. Can you explain that a little bit? I understand that someone could have lived with an abusive U.S. citizen, or let's just say that's their spouse, for about 2 weeks. And I understand that there's still a chance to file that VAWA self-petition at that point, just 2 weeks.
Right, exactly. Right. I had a case like that, and an applicant, a survivor of domestic violence, she was actually from Ukraine, and she was married to her abuser, and she lived with him only for 2 weeks. And that case was very interesting to me because there is a requirement to file, and the requirement is physical residence with an abuser. And, you know, I wasn't really sure while the requirement is there, but they only lived for 2 weeks, so I wasn't sure how that was going to play out. But, you know, amazingly, she was approved for VAWA just because the abuse was just horrible. But she lived with him only for 2 weeks, so it was very successful case, even though their life together was so short.
And I even understand that there's a time limit, though, in which you can file this petition. So if an immigrant divorces an abuser, there's a time frame on when she can file about this abuse?
Yes, they have only 2 years after the divorce is final.
At least there's some protection, y'all, even for people who are not in this country, that the law still does not allow people to just abuse other people. Can someone give out a hotline number? We want to give out that hotline throughout the show. If someone is in trouble, is suffering from domestic violence, understand there is a national domestic hotline number. Can someone give that out?
This is Diana. I have it. It's a national domestic violence hotline. It's 800-799-7233.
Or that's 1-800-799-SAFE, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Safe. Uh-huh.
If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, domestic violence, the not-so-silent killer. We're talking with Diana Franzetti and Brandy Smith with Brighter Tomorrows. We're also talking to Rita Smith with the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And we're also talking with attorney Anna Valentina with the Valentina Law Offices in the New York area. There's so much, y'all, about domestic violence that we don't understand because there's so many different reasons it can occur. It can be due to the person just being evil and cold-blooded. It could be to mental illness, I understand. What other reasons would someone abuse another person? Are there other known reasons? I guess not.
Carrie, this is Rita. I think the most important reason that people abuse someone else is because they can. Because right now the consequences still are not significant enough, consistent enough, and universal enough for that norm to be different. There are too many people, whether it's friends or family, willing to excuse that behavior, to try to find a reason why she did something that might have, you know, irritated him, or she's not a good enough mother, or there's just all kinds of excuses that are made for why he is violent, and it's predominantly he is violent. There are women who are abusive, but it's mostly men abusing women, and I think the biggest reason is because right now they can, and there are so few consequences for when they do. That it's still not enough of a consequence to stop their behavior.
What type of prison terms are we talking about for people accused of domestic violence? What type of prison sentences are? We know in this country that, you know, when we see a child molester convicted, typically he gets like 3 to 5 years and a slap on the wrist and he's out. What type of time are we looking at for people who are found guilty of domestic abuse?
There's people with felonies walking around, so, you know, it could be anywhere from 3 months to
2 years to, well, you know, I have somebody that's sentenced 10 years. So it just depends on the case and how many times he's been slapped on the wrist. A lot of times they try to get them into a batterer's intervention prevention program, which is BIP. I worked with a couple of BIP. I've facilitated a couple of BIP groups, so I started working on the other side with the guys, and it's very interesting. I think Rita's right. A lot of times they're not held accountable, and the best thing that you can do for someone is hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. You know, label the behavior. It's not okay for him to blame her. They're not allowed to blame her in the group. They're not allowed to minimize the abuse, and they have to be accountable to what they've done. And it's not about condemning them. It's about holding them responsible for the abuse. They have a belief system that has to be challenged. If you think someone has less value than you, then you can commit abuse against them. So they have to be challenged.
Have to be challenged. That's a good way of putting that. You know, domestic violence is one of those crimes where, you know, your neighbor may know is happening to you and not get involved. And a lot of times family members know of it going on and don't get involved. Why is that? Why is it that people will know about domestic violence and everybody just kind of considers that something between the couple and that, you know, it's not for you to stick your nose into? Why do you think that is? Rita.
Well, I think that that's just been the way that it's been presented for literally centuries, that it's a family matter and it's not of our none of our business. It's becoming more and more of our business. It should always have been our business. It's important to know whether or not your community, your neighborhood, your family, your faith community is safe. I mean, it should be a primary factor for everybody, but it hasn't been. And I think that more people need to start putting the pieces of the puzzle together and recognizing that, you know, not less than a year ago in Seal Beach, California, there was multiple homicides in a salon because that's where he found her. He wanted to kill her. She was at work. He went and he killed everybody in the salon. You fast forward to Wisconsin where there's a day spa. Again, he found her at work and he killed other people in the day spa. You know, women have been murdered in church on Sunday because that's where he knew she was going to be. This, you know, in Target parking lot, in, you know, Walmart stores. And, you know, there isn't a place now that's safe for the rest of us because as women are working and the only place he knows where he's going to be able to find her consistently is that workplace, then we are all in danger now. It's not just about what happens behind closed doors. And so we really all have to start addressing this, to really holding these guys accountable and making sure that the women have resources and accesses and the programs are supported to the extent they need to be supported. We will not be able to function as a society if programs that support domestic violence prevention go away. We have to change the norm here and make it not acceptable to hurt somebody you say you love.
This is Diana. If I could say this, I gave a presentation about a week ago to a women's group, and during that, in the question and answer, I had a woman ask, she said, I have a friend who I think may be in trouble with domestic violence, but I'm afraid if I say something to her, it will jeopardize our friendship. And I immediately said, you have to say something to her. You may be saving her life and her children. And if it jeopardizes your friendship, then so be it. But at least you might bring it to the forefront for her, and she can be encouraged to get help. So I think it is for all of us to say, to step in if we think. And if it means you lose somebody's friendship, but in the end you've saved their life, then, of course, that's, in my opinion, worth it.
Well, let's talk about intervening in a situation where you believe someone you love or someone you know is being abused. you know, it's a very sticky situation because, you know, like she said, that the lady may not appreciate her intervening. However, when you are the person that's intervening, how careful do you have to be about the information you're giving? Because a lot of times, you know, right off the cuff, we'll tell the person, oh, if I was you, I would leave. I would not take that. Don't we have to be careful about, you know, advice when we're given in a situation like that and maybe refer them to an agency such as Brighter Tomorrows or the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence rather than kind of tell them what we think they ought to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to be careful what you say. Rita will probably want to jump in on this too. But, yes, we and Brandy answers our hotline among some of our other case managers. Oh, this is Diana. Safety planning is huge, huge. And there may be, somebody may call 20 times, and we work with them for safety planning, and we all clearly don't say, well, unless they're in a hurtful or scary situation, you know, immediate danger, then we work with them to get them out of that. But otherwise, work with safety planning.
Yeah, if it's a friend or a family member, I always tell people, you know, give them the resources so they can talk to an advocate. And like Diana said, this is Brandy. I work on the hotline, and all my case managers and counselors know how to answer the hotline. And, you know, and the thing is that safety planning is very specific to the individual. You know, when we think about someone with immigration issues, if she's in that home, I want her to get certain documents in order because, you know, once she leaves, she might not be able to go back for that. You know, there's a whole list of things that she has to get for the immigration, her immigration papers to even do the VAWA and things like that. So safety planning is very specific. You have to think about the kids, like how you're safely going to get them transferred from one school to the next without leading a trail, because that's the easiest trail for guys to find. So there's a lot of specific things that go on when you're safety planning with someone, and someone who knows, who's been doing that and been trained to do it, should be helping those people.
I understand. We're going to talk about the checklist now, y'all. I understand there's a checklist, and which makes a whole lot of sense once I read it. When you feel like it's time to go, you know, I had an old aunt that used to say about a bad relationship or a bad marriage, take it until you can't take it no more, and when you leave, don't look back. That said, you're going to have to put together these items so that you don't look back. And
yeah.
Does anybody have that checklist and want to go over it with me? Or I'll start. I'll tell you. Under the identification section of the checklist, they said you need things like your driver's license, your birth certificate, your children's birth certificate, and your Social Security cards.
Yes.
Is there anything else y'all would add to the identification?
Health insurance information, if you have it.
Yeah. Insurance. Yeah.
Okay, insurance, okay.
Car insurance, health insurance, life policies, yeah.
Okay. Financial, y'all, they said that you need to get money and or credit cards in your name, checking or saving account books. Which
yeah,
y'all
if I go any further and to say to even pull papers of his information, if a person has time, like keep in mind, I don't. Their lives are way more important than anything they could go back for. But just because dealing with some of the legal is one of the hardest issues that our clients have to deal with. And if they, you know, he might be financially set, but he knows how to hide his money or hide accounts from her.
Yeah.
If she can get any type of information on him, that'd be great. That's ideal.
Yeah.
But we're talking about this checklist, y'all. I'm talking about if you think you possibly in trouble, the checklist, the time to get the checklist ready is now. I would think, not waiting until, you know, it's, you know, you have to leave in the middle of the night. I would think packing a bag and putting these things aside would be absolutely necessary if you feel like you're in a situation of domestic abuse and you feel like
that's
at some point you can make an exit.
Listening to call their crisis hotline in their area and start working with them to get all this information together.
Okay. I agree with you. Listen, call the crisis hotline, y'all. Another thing that they had a list of legal papers. They you should get protection orders, if you have your protection orders in place, lease, rental agreements, and house deeds, car registration, like someone had mentioned earlier, your insurance papers, health and life insurance, somebody mentioned that earlier, medical records for you and your children, school records, work permits, green cards, visas, passports, divorce and custody papers, marriage license. Would y'all add anything else to the legal papers?
That's a lot of them. That, you know, you mentioned, like, these are things, like, on the run, but most of the time when people are planning, they are planning this out for, like, weeks or months. So sometimes it's not on the run. Usually if someone's running out the door, it's because they're in immediate danger that very moment. So this checklist is for those things that you get to think about and plan ahead for.
I agree. The last group, y'all, was just under other, and they said things like medication, house and car keys, valuable jewelry, address books, pictures and sentimental items, and a change of clothes for you and your children. So like you say, this would be something where somebody had some time to really sit down and say, you know, I'm planning my escape, and I'm going to be detailed about it, and I'm going to leave and not have to go back for anything.
Yeah, Carrie, this is Rita. I think that if somebody has the time to do this kind of safety planning and they're waiting to gather up enough loose cash, you know, to sort of cobble together enough loose cash to feel like they can walk out the door and not look back or whatever that strategy is, one of the things that's really helpful for them to do is if they have a friend or a family member where they can put all these items in a safe place so that he doesn't find them, you know, this little stash of her escape material. It's always good if you have an additional person that you can, even if it's a neighbor, you know, just pack a suitcase with all these things and just say, you know, this is kind of my emergency preparedness, you know, baggage, and you know, I'd like to leave it here in case something happens. And then she's able to go get it safely, and it's still there and it's not destroyed because he found it.
I sometimes suggest my immigrant survivors of domestic violence, I suggest to them to rent a safe deposit box, because you have to understand frequently they don't have friends in the United States, they don't have relatives, they don't have family here, so they don't really have that friend or that relative that they can store their things with. So I suggest a safe deposit box, and I know many of my clients use that option, and it really worked because their documents were safe.
Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense because, you know, sometimes you don't have anybody you can trust.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I absolutely agree with that. You know, we're in the holiday times right now, y'all, and a lot of people suffer from depression, you know, right here at the holiday times. Are situations of domestic abuse higher during the holidays than they are at other times?
I looked at the national statistics on this. The actual hotline calls actually go down during the holidays, but there's a lot of anecdotal stuff, like the officers feel like there's higher tension and more stuff going on. Service workers might hear more stuff from their clients, but families are really wanting to, like, spend time together during the holidays and hoping that things will be better during the holidays. Rita might have some information about any different statistics, but that's what I found from the national studies, that there wasn't anything specifically saying that, yes, this is what's going on at the holidays.
Really? I guess that's good to know. I would think that, you know, depression would be higher, and therefore the abuser would, you know, be more agitated and therefore be more abusive, but possibly not. You know, I looked at a lot of statistics on this because I was really, after the Javon Belcher and Cassandra Perkins murder-suicide, I, like most people, was left with why. I just couldn't understand why someone would do that. And I just, I you know, one of the statistics that I found that is a possible reason for why, but we'll never know. It says witnessing violence between one's parents or caregiver is the strongest risk factor of transmitting violent behavior from one generation to the next. Does anybody think that maybe Javon Belcher may have been, you know, exposed to domestic violence maybe as a child? Or maybe playing football. I don't know.
I don't know. I thought about the football thing. I think some of your other people who were presenting were saying, you know, there's lots of football players that don't commit violence. For that night alone, it doesn't help that he had been drinking. Drinking is not the reason why someone abuses, but it only escalates the violence. And I don't know. I don't want to comment on his family life because I don't know that his mom, you know, was a victim of family violence. I don't want to speculate about anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it was mentioned that he said, "You can't talk to me like that," it was a clear indication to me that he, again, going back to that belief system, that he believed that she didn't have a right to question him. That it sounded like that night they had both been out, and so I'm sure there was a lot of jealousy going around, and the fact that he had been drinking, and I think that escalates the violence. And so, like we were saying, during the holidays, people tend to drink more during the holidays, and it only makes things worse. I always tell my women, do not argue with someone who's been on – who's drinking or using, because you will never reason with them. You can't.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I agree, because, you know, the thing is, when someone is angry already, and they said at some point during the night he had called her and told her to go home or come home, because he wasn't home himself, so I guess he was just giving direction that she needed to get home. I don't know. But which is to me, I don't know. It just seems like it was an unbalanced relationship, you know, and like I said, nobody's mentioned abuse, but it's just one of those things I question whether or not that may have been part of the situation. But looking at Javon Belcher and the Cassandra Perkins murder-suicide, so many people were just, I think it was Diana that I talked to, where we were talking about the fact that he was so well-liked. I don't know if it was Diana or Rita mentioned it on the website. I'm getting confused, y'all. But somewhere I saw that, or I was talking to someone about it, and it was the fact that he was so well-liked. Was that on your website, Rita, where you said he was well-liked?
Well, you know, I think that's all the media could talk about, is what a nice guy he was, and he was, you know, had a good work ethic, and, you know, and then several days later you start to get the background. The fact that they had been separated already, that there had been some struggles within the relationship, that he had, even going back to Maine when he was at school in college, that he had had some incidences of potential violence against women there as a college student and football player. And so you start looking at the background, and so that's the thing that people need to understand about people who are abusers. They are very, very good at presenting an image that they want you to have of them. That's how they hook these women. They learn everything that's important to them, and they give them what they want, and they make them feel really important in their life. And what most women don't understand is that what they're also doing is filing that information away for future use as weapons, to know what's most important to you, what you care about, the things that are, you know, the property items that you have that are really important to you. They file all this information away to use later to abuse you and hurt you. But I think that's people focus on, well, you know, he shoveled my walk, you know, and or he always said hi, or he, you know, he's out in the yard playing with the kids. And, you know, it's like, yeah, that's just one side of this person. The side that you don't see is a side where they are coercing and terrorizing their family on a fairly regular basis. And so, you know, you have to look underneath that veil to find out what's happening.
I agree.
Yeah, this is Diana. We've had instances of clients saying that the abuser has said, "No one's going to ever believe you. Look at me. I have this kind of job. I go to work every day. I drive a nice car. You know, I look pretty nice. No one's going to believe you that I'm even doing any of this stuff." So that's not only denigrating what they're thinking, but it's another form of abuse, of just saying, no one's going to believe you, so, you know, you don't have a chance.
Well, that segues into my next question. Should someone keep a journal in some type of documentation of the abuse, like pictures, you know, notes of what happened and, you know, injuries, that type of thing. Should that be the case?
If they do, I suggest that, like Rita said, keep it with a friend.
Yeah.
And really? Not anything written down where he can find it, because I think that actually happened to one of my people, is that she was, you know, journaling was a form of expression for her, and something I always encourage with people if they need to, but not if you're still in the situation where he can find it and use it against her. That's awful. It's awful.
I agree. And for the purposes of an immigration application, immigration for permanent residency, this journal can be very important because it can corroborate statements from witnesses and other types of evidence. But I always repeat it to my clients many times. Keep it maybe on your computer and make sure it's password protected. And better yet, keep it with a friend, keep it with a relative. If you don't have friends or relatives, keep it in their safe deposit box. And you know, they usually, if they have the journal, we can very effectively use them for the immigration cases.
Mm. One statistic that I read that was really scary, y'all, that said almost one-third of female homicide victims that are reported in police records are killed by the intimate partner. So it almost seems like, you know, when you, you know, report it, that puts you in greater danger. I don't know. I mean, y'all are the experts. Tell me tonight. But, I mean, those are staggering numbers, almost one-third. That's pretty high. I mean, don't get me wrong. I would not tell anybody not to report it, because I think, you know what, I'd rather report it than not report it, because, you know, I just feel like maybe the system will work for me. I think that's how I feel about it. But are those numbers correct? Did I get the right numbers, one-third?
Yeah, Carrie, this is Rita. That's accurate. That most female, the perpetrator who kills most women is someone they know or have been intimate with, yes. And that's also true of most of the perpetrators of sexual assault or sexual violence are actually known to the victim. So what that means is that, you know, you can either go down in a hole and never come out, or you can educate yourself about what the warning signs are. Always pay attention. I think women have sort of this innate something's not right here feeling, whether they're walking on the street or they're in a situation with some guy that it's starting to feel weird, or they're in a situation in a relationship where something is happening or some pattern is starting to be developed that you feel like you're losing yourself, or your freedoms are being constricted, or you're being more and more isolated. I think we have sort of a sense of something's wrong here, and most of the time we push that down and say, don't be silly, or, you know, you're just being paranoid, or I think we self-deny a lot. And we need to stop doing that, because I think we have this this sort of little radar that goes off to say, you know, for lack of better words, danger, danger, Will Robertson. You know, it's like you need to pay attention. You know, something's not fitting here. And we need to, you know, get better at honing that skill rather than denying it.
Randy, I agree with Rita. A lot of times my clients will ask me, you know, how can I trust somebody again? And I tell them, I've learned over the years, it's not about trusting the other person. It's about trusting yourself. And listening to that inner voice, like Rita was talking about, and saying, you know, this isn't right for me. Something feels wrong. I need to step back here and start listening to our instincts so that we, you know, don't go down that same road.
I love that. Now, are we, you know, what Rita just spoke of, are we talking about warning signs that an abusive situation is about to turn deadly, or are we talking about just warning signs that this domestic abuse situation is not good for me?
This is Rita. I think that I have worked in this field since 1981, and I've worked a lot with men and women who work with abusers. And I don't know any of them who can tell me which ones will follow through on a death threat and which ones won't. We don't know how to do that. And most every abuser I've ever heard about from a survivor has threatened to kill her.
Yeah.
So my sort of repeated echo everywhere I go is that we treat every case as if it could be lethal. We treat every case as if the potential for homicide is there. We don't assume that because they make a lot of money or they live in poverty or they're a particular culture or they have a particular faith, we don't assume anything about what their capabilities are. If they've made the threat, they have the capacity, and we need to respond to the potential for that capacity rather than assuming we're going to be able to figure out who's really in danger.
So if someone tells you, I'm going to kill you, you should believe them.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And how many women, you know, I don't know, and there's no telling what the number is, and there's no statistics on that, y'all, but I wonder how many women their partner had said that to them and they did not heed the warning.
Wow.
You know, I mean, to me,
30% of the domestic violence homicide victims did not heed the warning or couldn't protect themselves. So there's an awful lot of women who are murdered who got restraining orders, who left the relationship, who were doing everything they could rather than disappearing, and still were killed and found and tracked down. So I think that it, you know, I think most women who are victims of domestic violence and die probably heeded the warning on some level. What links they went to in heeding that warning may be restricted to whether they were capable of leaving the area completely, whether they could, you know, find another job and find another school for their kids and completely disappear and get their Social Security number changed. And, you know, I think that most women want to deny it because you're looking at this person that you might have had children with, and it's really hard for you to believe that they're going to kill you. But it's also not hard to believe when you think about when he said it and what he was feeling and how scared you were at the time. So I think you know, it's just reinforcing for those women that what your instincts are very important. They've kept you alive up to now. If you're afraid, pay attention to that and start to respond to that.
Yeah.
If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, domestic violence, the not-so-silent killer. We're talking to Diana Franzetti and Brandy Smith of Brighter Tomorrows. And we're also talking to Rita Smith with the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And also with us is attorney Anna Valentini. She's with the Valentini Law Offices up in the New York area. Also a reminder, the chat room is down tonight, so if you have a question or a comment, get on the phone lines. Call us up at 347-850-8390, then press 1. Again, the chat room is down tonight, so if you'd like to pose a question to our guest, you need to call in at 347-850-8390 and then press 1. Some of the statistics that I saw were very interesting as well. It says, boys who witness domestic violence are twice as likely to abuse their own partners and children when they become adults. So, you know, it just says to me, like, wow, you know, it is imprinted on their brains. I mean, when they see this, they may not say anything, but it's putting a lasting imprint on their brain, which just blew me away. Y'all, we're going to go to the phone lines. We're going to pick up 682-323. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hey, Miss Carrie. I'm in joint center stage. I love this topic that you guys are talking about.
Thank you.
Good evening, ladies. I definitely want to say that you guys are coming and giving some really, really good advice. But I definitely want to ask you a question about what is the percentage of how many males are also abused? I know we talk about women all the time, but what about men? Because I think a lot of men get abused just as much as the women do.
That's a good question. Anybody have numbers on that?
I think it's 1 in 6. Rita, you might know if there's any different statistic on that.
No, I think it's pretty accurate. What it seems to indicate, what the statistics seem to indicate, is that when men are abused, they tend not to be injured as much. So that injuries tend to be higher when women are abused by men than men abused by women. But I do think that it does happen. And in the category of men, you also have to look at men being abused by gay men. So in their gay relationships.
Sure.
I think it's somewhere around 5 to 10%.
And they don't report as often. Men don't report as often because, you know, that whole myth that men can't be abused, and that's just simply not true. And the one thing I wanted to comment on, the difference between men and women, you know, again, I have women that say, oh, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm the abuser. And so we talk about that. I'm like, everyone's capable of behaving badly in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The abuse is when there's a systematic pattern of control and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want people to understand that there's a pattern of abuse that goes on. And men tend to have a long-term pattern going. Women mm-hmm. sometimes will abuse in short-term instances when they want to regain some sort of power. So sometimes there is that cycle that goes on between them, but it really is, you know, I don't want it to seem like she's the abuser. I'm just saying she might get caught up and engage in some abusive behavior,
mm-hmm.
But it might be to gain some short-term control of the situation.
Let me ask you this real quick, because my sister, she's not in an abusive relationship, but she abuses her fiancé. And
okay.
She brags about it, and she thinks it's so cute. And I keep telling her, you can't keep on doing it like that. And he gets to the point where he gets so frustrated. As a matter of fact, he called my mama one day and told my mama, because he called my mama and said, Mama, I had to leave your daughter. I had to leave out and walk out because I was afraid I was going to do something bad to her. So kind of give me the rundown about that. What are your thoughts on that?
Out on her behavior, tell her that that's not acceptable and it's not healthy, and it's, you know, that's not a way to have a relationship. And you know, and then he did the right thing. He walked out before it escalated.
And that's a good lead way into my next question. What is the best way to diffuse an argument when you see the tension on the other person is really getting, you know, higher than you're comfortable with? What is the best way? He just said the young man chose to walk out. What's the best way to diffuse a situation? Walking out doesn't always work because somebody, you know, may not like the fact you're turning your back on them while they're talking.
Uh-huh.
But what's the best way to diffuse a situation that you see is getting out of control?
For my women, I encourage them, like, if they see that it's escalating, that, you know, it's not the responsibility, but, you know, and that's hard because they're not responsible for what happens to them, but they can work to de-escalate it. But I don't want it to come off as that they're at fault if he continues with the pattern. But, you know, try to leave the situation if she can. Definitely, you know, I do have fighters. I have ones that are like, you know, that's not right for you to talk to me. You mentioned earlier about, like, how it was unbalanced in the with Javon Belcher.
Mm-hmm.
Like he could do it and she couldn't. The double standard is very common in these relationships. Like he can do it, but she can't. So I have people who want to stand up for themselves. In that moment, I tell them, you know, I understand wanting to, but just don't, because you don't want to escalate the situation. Don't cuss. Don't yell. Lower your voice. Try to get out of the house if you can. Anybody else? I mean, those are some of the things that I suggest.
If you're leaving a situation and you know you're leaving, and you've made up in your mind, okay, I've got to leave and I'm going to get out of this, what are things that you should never say? I think it was said that Cassandra Perkins said to Javon Belcher at some point, and I don't know if it happened that particular day, but it was reported in the news that she told him that she was leaving for good and that she was going to get full custody of the child and that she was lawyering up. Are those, like, words that you should never say to an abuser?
Yeah, because it's saying you're not going to have control over me anymore, and the whole purpose is to control you.
Mm.
So she's telling him, what's going to happen, and he's saying, no, it's not.
And this is Diane, and he'll do whatever he has to do, obviously, to stop her from that. So we definitely recommend not saying that. You can plan to do that, but definitely don't tell the abuser that you're going to do that.
Right. I think isn't there a term, separation violence?
Hmm.
I think there is a term, separation violence, that describes exactly this type of situation when the victim of domestic violence says, okay, I'm about to leave and I made preparations for leaving, like lawyering up. That's the point when the violence escalates and that ends even to the point of murder. And I think that's what in some literature, that's what's called separation violence, when the violence escalates to that point upon the news of the abuser losing the control of the victim.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes.
Wow. You know, I've wondered about this since I've started preparing for this show, and if it doesn't exist, you all tell me, I think it should. If someone is in a situation where they're being just really battered and they need the police to get out there really quickly, if they're able to get a 911 operator on the phone, and I'm sure if you all heard the show last week, the 911 operator that handled the Javon Belcher call from his mother that day she was horrible. I mean, in my opinion, and I'm not trained, but just from listening, it made me cringe because it just seemed like she was battering the person and they were saying, can you get me some help? You know, this situation is really bad. Can you get me some help? That said, if someone is being battered and they can manage to get to the phone and dial 911, is there a code that exists to say, you know, domestic situation, hurry, I think he's going to kill me? Is there anything in place with our systems right now that deals with that?
Not that I know of. Not with 911.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody can call in if there is a code and we don't know about it. That'd be good to know.
Yeah.
I can just imagine if you're running, you know, and you manage to get upstairs and you shut the door and you lock it in the bedroom and you're able to get 911 on the phone, if he's bamming at the bedroom door threatening to kick it in, you don't have time to say, my name is XYZ and I live at this address and it's my husband and he's gone. I don't think it's time for that. And
well,
so,
listen to the 911 thing, and I hear what you're saying. There were some parts that, yeah, did strike as a little odd. But one of the things about 911, they do have to get some information because, for instance, like she kept asking, is he in the house? Because the police officers want to know if he's in the house with a gun. And so that
tell
might
her no, and she still kept asking more questions. I think I heard, didn't you hear her say no? Almost immediately?
I had a hard time hearing and understanding everything because it sounded like it cut out a whole bunch.
Okay.
Or there was some beeping. I didn't hear everything. But I'm not disagreeing or agreeing that it was, you know, awful 911 call. But I know that sometimes they need the information in regards to, like, is the perpetrator still on property because the police are going into a situation. But, yes, they didn't even get a chance to do the life-saving stuff that you were mentioning because they were too busy asking other questions.
And, you know, Brandy and Diana live in the Dallas area. Wasn't it just a couple of months ago that a woman called 911 in Dallas and said she was in trouble and the guy was killing her, and basically the 911 operator heard the whole thing on the phone?
Yeah, oh,
it was just about
that. Sounds awful. I don't know. I didn't hear about that situation. Did you, Diana?
No, I didn't. This is Diana. I didn't hear about that, but I know that on 911 calls sometimes you can hear, you know, that the door is being broken down or that somebody's being choked or whatever.
I mean, on our own hotline calls,
right.
We had a situation where a woman, I mean, she wasn't even in our same city, and we had her, she had been drugged, she had been raped, and she was
wandering,
and you can hear the cars passing by. It was a very scary situation, and so as we're directing her, we're also trying to find out where she might be so that we can call 911. She was disoriented because he had been drugging her.
Mm.
So it's a very, those calls are very scary. And our advocates, they did an awesome job. They saved her life.
Yeah, somebody else was able to get the police while the other advocate was talking to her on the phone, and she didn't know where she was, and they were trying to keep her off the street, and as Brandy said, the cars and whatnot. So they, our advocates actually heard the police arrive and get her, and then the phone went dead. Mm-hmm. So she was saved. She was saved.
Let me ask you this. In Brighter Tomorrows, have you all ever lost any clients due to domestic violence?
That's a hard question. I lost a client, but it wasn't due to domestic violence. Unfortunate. She coped with drugs, and it was a drug overdose. But I don't know of anybody that we've lost. I tell Diana, I joke with her that I don't always watch the news because this is my life during the day. So when I go home, I mean, if you watch the news, it's inundated with family violence and gun shootings and things like that.
Well, and this is Diana, and Rita may want to address this too, but, you know, when we have clients leave our shelter or our transitional housing, we have a wonderful transitional housing program for women a little further along on their journey. They're able to live in more independently in an apartment that we pay for. But sometimes when they graduate or exit that program or definitely our shelters, you know, we don't know where they go, and we don't know if they perhaps are killed in a year or two or whatever because they've gone back to the abuser, or they might find themselves in another abusive situation. So it's very difficult sometimes to track the clients that we work with because they either are back with their abuser or they don't want to even think or deal with domestic violence again, and they don't want to have anything to do with Brighter Tomorrows, and which is perfectly understandable. So it's very difficult for us to get those statistics on how they're doing after they exit our program.
And let's talk about the fact that I think, if I'm correct, Brighter Tomorrows and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence are like 501c3s that you can donate to?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, ma'am. We're going to beg for some money tonight. Y'all help these causes. I mean, because it sounds like it's great work that you all are doing, and it's not work that everybody wants to do.
This is Diana. I'm sure Rita does talks when she gives talks and presentations. You know, 501 nonprofit organizations are, if you will, owned by the community. They're there for the good of the community. And if Brighter Tomorrows and all of the other wonderful emergency safe shelters that we have in Dallas and all over the United States weren't there, where would these people go? Last year we housed, and I'd like to talk about the children if we get a chance to, 574 children. Just last year, 480 women.
Wow.
We served almost 40,000 meals. So that is about 72 people in our two shelters total every night. Imagine taking care of them. And they come to us with nothing. So we need money. We need money to keep the doors open and keep the electricity going and the phones on and food. And, I mean, sometimes they come to us and they don't even have any undergarments. You know, we have to go out and buy that, or if you can support any of the domestic violence emergency shelters in your community, please, please do so, because it is a constant battle to take care of everybody. It is amazing what we have to do.
Well, Rita Smith, does the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence need money?
Well, yes. The issue around nonprofits is that every year you have to start over again. It's not like you have so much money that you're like putting it in the bank and you're sticking it in, interest-bearing accounts. We pretty much live hand-to-mouth and because we are doing such enormously powerful work. But also I think that what's important for people to recognize, there are lots of different ways to help. You know, sometimes there are fundraising events that local programs do that you can volunteer for. If you can't give money, you can certainly volunteer time and help make that fundraising event more successful. A lot of programs have cell phone donation programs. We have one at the National Coalition. We recycle cell phones and electronics to raise money for ourselves. And so there are lots of local programs that have those kind of systems as well. Donating goods food or diapers or clothing, it really helps keep those costs down for the programs, because then they don't have to spend money to go buy those things, and they can use it to pay for the staff necessary to really make sure that people are safe 24 hours a day. And so, I think that there's a lot of different ways people can help. And you know, my only challenge to people listening is that you do something. You do something. You take one action, whether it's, donating $10 or getting volunteer training and helping answer the crisis line. There's a wide range of ways that you can help on this issue. And we need everybody to jump in and do something, because we're never going to stop this with just having a building where people go to hide. That's not how we're going to stop this kind of violence. It's going to be something that the community takes on and starts to change the acceptance and tolerance of the use of violence against someone you say you love. You have to stop that behavior and stop making it acceptable. And people will begin to stop doing it a lot more frequently if everyone around them is saying, that's not appropriate, you can't do that, that's not how you treat someone you care about. So
100% agree. Diana, you wanted to speak about the children?
Well, yes, you had talked earlier about the children that experience or see domestic violence. The statistics show they have a much greater chance of becoming involved with drugs and alcohol as teenagers. Teen pregnancy rises, and they become more likely to become an abuser or to actually be the person who is abused in the relationship just from having lived in a domestic violence situation as a child. And as I said, last year we housed 574 kids. So we take those kids, and they range anywhere from, infants to 17 years old. And in 10 years, they're going to be out there in the community, and what's going to be, we're going to have to be taking care of them most likely, too. And just multiply that by every community in the United States. So it is an overwhelming problem that we all need to address and be aware of. As Rita said, I have to echo and many times over what she said, that we just can't allow it to happen. As we are, when we are at information fairs or whatever, I see people that see our booth and they steer away from it. They don't even want to talk about it. They don't even want to know about it, and that's a shame. And it's there. We have to acknowledge it and start speaking out against it.
I 100% agree again. Attorney Valentini, should you always tell someone about a situation of domestic abuse, even if you don't report it to the police?
You mean if you should inform or if you should share with people about you being in this abusive situation?
If you know someone that you can trust, isn't it always, even if you don't report it to police, necessary that you tell someone else about the abuse?
Absolutely. Thing is going to be very beneficial to this survivor's mental state, just to share this information with somebody, just to talk it over. And also, I think just by discussing this issue, they might realize that they're in this situation, this abusive situation, and seek outside help, seek help beyond their friends or relatives. And also, if anything else, in terms of their later possible immigration benefits application, if they talk to somebody and discuss this abusive situation with somebody, be it a neighbor or a coworker, then that person can always write an affidavit for them and corroborate their story. So I think it's extremely important if we're talking about immigrant survivors of domestic violence or U.S. citizens. I think it's very important, very beneficial for them to share their story with people that they can trust.
Yes.
We're going to go back to the phone lines. We're going to pick up area code 678-508. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Hello, how are you doing? This is Missy in Atlanta.
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Hey, I wanted to offer a suggestion only to hopefully bring balance to the conversation. I love these type of conversations, but I think many of times, as I've heard today, let me back up. When the lady says that hopefully we can eradicate the situation, this is my hope too. But I think we get a little disingenuous when we make it a, when we come across as an all men are evil type of conversation, he, him, his. I wanted to suggest to you that unfortunately you have partner-to-partner abuse that's on the rise. You have partner-to-partner abuse, meaning lesbian, gay community, whole thing. And I think a lot of times people, in my personal experience, people do not want to get involved and or people do not want to get help for their situation because there's an alienation going on. And especially for whomever the abuser is, they don't have the access to change as openly as some other scenarios for the victim. And I understand everything is about the victim. The victim doesn't deserve it. But I think in order for us to get to the part of eradication, there has to be an honesty that there is little to no avenues for those who seek change. It just, like you said, with the little child, and I think of Chris Brown a lot of times. Everybody was horrified about the whole Chris Brown thing, but they forgot this lady was older than this little young 16-year-old boy. And while this young 16-year-old boy did lash back at this older woman that he was dating, nobody put into any thought process the mental abuse he may have been taking before he lashed out. So I just really get disheartened because I would like to see it eradicated when most of the conversations are he, him, his, and things of that nature, when that's not the complexity of the abuse, violence, domestic violence scenario. And I just wish people would be a little bit more honest in how they approach it so that we can get everybody to the table to eradicate.
Caller, with all due respect, I think our previous caller mentioned his question, if you were not listening, was about how often is abuse perpetrated against males. And I believe our panel told him one out of six males are victims of abuse. Was that not the number, Diana, or whoever answered the question?
Yes, you're correct. One in six men.
So
and there are avenues for guys that want to make changes and for women who want to make changes because the Batterers Intervention Prevention programs that we have in Dallas, they have programs for women and for men who are abusive. And also, there's not very many of them, but you did mention intimate partner violence between gay and lesbian couples, and they also have groups for those as well with some of the organizations that are in Dallas. So, you know, we do predominantly talk about it happening with men because it is considered more of a male issue. But I do agree that there are definitely women out there who are abusive.
All right, and that's all I wanted to suggest for the conversation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, one thing that I've noticed, I've said it many times on this show, if I come across a domestic situation, like if I'm in the, let's just say, the parking lot of a mall, and I see a man, let's just say, abusing his wife, I'm the type who would get at a safe distance, call 911 and get him some help, but I would not dare try to get in between the situation because I don't know what happened and what happened before, you know, whatever I witnessed. That said, a lot of times third parties end up dying trying to help someone in a domestic situation. So is it wise to take someone into your home if they're fleeing a domestic abuser?
It depends on the I think it depends on the situation. I know that if he or she does not know where the survivor's family or friends are, then you know that's something you can do. But always, always call the police. Don't open the door if he comes by or she comes by. So I think it depends on the situation. And I agree with you. Do not physically intervene in a situation that's going on right in front of you. I always, always tell people to call the police immediately.
Because a lot of times a guy will think, well, you know, there's a guy beating up on his girlfriend or his wife, so I'm going to go over there and stop him from doing it. But many people have been killed intervening in domestic situations.
That's unfortunate.
And I'm just saying that, y'all, I'm not a coward. I just think it's a bit of common sense not to always just jump right into something just because it's, you see what's being done is wrong, but sometimes there's a degree of violence involved, and you just really should use some caution when jumping into it. Some other statistics that I saw that I wanted to talk about is the warning signs of, are you being abused? Because a lot of people are in denial about whether or not they're really being abused, which I find it hard to believe, but it happens. So some of the statistics that I saw, or some of the information, I should say, some of the data I came across about whether or not you're being abused. One of the things says that does he embarrass you with put-downs? The other thing was look at you and act in ways that scare you. So if you're in fear of your partner, I would say love doesn't hit. So if you're in fear of your partner being abusive to you, that would be an indicator that you are being abused. Another thing said he controls what you do, who you see, who you talk to, and where you go, that's an indicator of the fact that you're in an abusive situation. Another thing was that does he stop you from seeing your friends and family? I want y'all to speak on that. Isolation. Isn't the fact that your partner wants you to be isolated from your family and friends, isn't that an indicator that you're in trouble?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So never allow yourself to be isolated.
No. You still need to – you're not just his girlfriend or his wife. You are somebody's daughter, mother, friend, sister, you know. You have a life outside of him, and then y'all bring those lives together in a healthy relationship. Isolation creates a danger situation for her. You know, friends and family end up turning them away from you, and then when you need the help, they're not there anymore because they've been shut out of your life. So yes, that's a big problem.
And you all can jump in on any of these that you want to make additional comments on as I'm going through them. Another thing they said, they take your money, make you ask for money, or refuse to give you money.
This is Diana. I know personally from a friend years ago, he would give her cash to go to the grocery store. She had to come back. He looked at the receipt. He looked at the change she brought back, and he checked to see what she bought. Now, if that is not control, I don't know what is. So, as I said earlier when we started the show, financial abuse, just that power and that control over somebody, that's huge. Obviously, we all need money, and we have some women come to our shelters that don't even know how to write a check because they haven't been allowed to. They certainly don't have a credit card. And they barely have any cash because they haven't been able to wrangle some out of the situation. So, yeah, that's It's very powerful to do that.
Sorry, it's Brandy. I would say that financial abuse is one of the reasons why she might still be in the relationship. She might have emotionally be done with this guy, but financially if he sets her up for failure and she can't get into a shelter, then she feels very stuck, very, very stuck.
And we have clients who have lost their good job because of their abuse, either because of physical or their isolation, or they've been locked in the house. I mean, and they can't go to their job, so they lose it. Now that's jeopardizing them getting another job. So, you know, it's just many, many layers to the situation that are devastating for many different reasons.
Wow. Another thing is that they make all the decisions. You know, if you're in a relationship where you can't make any decisions, I would think that's an indicator that you got problems.
When you start feeling like you don't know who you are anymore, that's the biggest thing my clients talk about. They're like, I don't even know who I am. It's because he creates doubt and he makes all the decisions. She can't even make a decision about what she wants to eat because he tells her what she's going to eat and things like that. So you mentioned, you know, love does not hit, but I really want to stress the point that, you know, physical and sexual abuse are very overt types of abuse, but it's the emotional abuse, the double standards, the mind games. Those mind games are meant to tear her down or tear him down, and it's what causes them to question, am I being abused?
Right. This is Diana. I know of a client who was in our shelter, and after a couple of days, staff realized she was sleeping on the floor in our shelter next to the bed we had provided for her because that is what, it was a man, what he made her do at home. And she didn't think she could sleep in the bed that we had given her. So if any listeners have any situations like that, then hopefully they will be calling their emergency hotline as soon as they safely can do that.
And we're going to give out that hotline number again. It's what? I just thought about it. We want to give that out throughout the show. The hotline number, if you are in trouble, if you are relating to the things that we're saying tonight, you need to call the hotline number when it's safe to do so, and that's 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Another thing that they said is that they tell you that you're a bad parent or threaten to take away or hurt your children. Wow. That's an indicator you got a problem. I mean, like, that's like the – wow. That's just like it's time to go. Let's just say, like, if somebody's doing that, that's an indicator it's time to go. If they're threatening to hurt your children, it's just time to go. Another thing is to prevent you from working or attending school. That's what I think Brandy just brought up, or Diana, whichever one of you all that just said that. So they're actually making you dependent upon them. It sounds like.
Yeah, I've noticed from my experience that frequently abusers, they try to undermine victims' self-worth and self-confidence. And many times, over and over and over, I hear the stories of abusers saying, well, you're too stupid to go to college. You're too stupid to get the job. You're too stupid to get a driver's license. And also, abusers frequently engage in this pattern of very not so subtle insults and mocking and humiliation in front of third parties. So, you know, abuse does not necessarily mean hitting. From what I see, many of abusive sedation is just basically constant emotional abuse, and it just would manifest itself in mocking, insults, and undermining person's self-worth and self-confidence.
So beating down your self-esteem.
Yeah,
I think that's what you're saying. Another thing they say is that they act like the abuse is no big deal. It's your fault, or even deny doing it.
They have a right to. I mean, just working with the guys in the groups, you know, again, these guys are very likable. Some of them are not necessarily like your sociopath that just have no remorse. Some of them are very likable guys, and they had this belief that, you know, that you do what I say and you obey what, you know, it's just distorted. So those things, it's just distorted.
Okay. Now we're talking about am I being abused? So if you're, you know, able to relate to some of these things that we're reading off here right now, that's probably a pretty clear indicator that you've got a problem and that this may be an abusive situation. Another thing that they say is that they destroy your property or threaten to kill your pets. That's an indicator that there's something going on that, you know, you should worry about. Another thing that I consider big is they intimidate you with guns, knives, or other weapons. If anybody's threatening anybody with weapons, who is that?
That's a huge lethality risk factor. Diana and I, in Dallas, they've been doing a research study on lethality. Mm-hmm. And if he threatens to kill you or if he has a gun, I don't know what there's certain questions that the police are supposed to ask now.
Mm-hmm.
And if they answer yes to certain questions, then their lethality jumps up. Rita might know what I'm talking about, the lethality assessment that came out of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having a gun is a big deal. Having a knife that they just even lay it in front of you is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie, I think what Brandy is talking about is a study that was done by Jacqueline Campbell out of Johns Hopkins University. She's at the School of Nursing, and she's done some really good work around lethality introduction of a weapon is really high up on the list, as is sexual assault. So if she's ever been forced to have sex against her will, then that is one of the indicators that it's a dangerous relationship. I think also if he has ever tried to strangle her.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some things that, some behaviors that one can start to look at to see whether or not their danger level is rising and the escalation of the violence is getting to the point where her life might actually be in huge danger. So I think that it's important for people to know what those things are, not so that it paralyzes them, but that it starts to help educate them about maybe increasing their actions towards safety. You know, the more informed you are, the more likely it is that you're going to get out alive with all of your most important possessions and your children intact. So that's really what doing shows like this is about, is trying to get people to understand, you know, what level of danger you're in, you know, what your resources are, and that you're not alone, that it's not about you, and that you can get away if you have enough help, and everyone needs help. You can't really do this by yourself because no one can predict what this abusive person is going to do. So you need help to figure out all the ways that you can be safe.
And this is Diana. I just echo what Rita said, and I know this is a lot of information for somebody who might be listening that might be in a situation like this, who might be being abused. I just can't emphasize enough, when you're in a safe place, call your local domestic violence emergency safe shelter hotline in your community, and they can start talking to you. I mean, you don't even have to do anything but just talk to them. Ours runs 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We get calls in the middle of the night. As Rita said, you're not alone, and there are many case managers who just know exactly what to ask you and what information to give you and the resources you can have. So I just can't emphasize that enough for anybody listening that even thinks they might be in this situation. Call and start getting resources and getting help.
Go back to the phone lines. Let's pick up area code 214-441. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Oh, yeah. I was listening to I actually lost a friend behind that. She had left. She was getting a divorce. She had left him, but he told her to come back. He wanted to hold her for the last time, and he shot and killed her.
Oh,
Sorry.
So, yeah, so, you know, when they tell you that, you shouldn't even go back, should you?
But he didn't threaten it. Had he ever told her he was going to kill her?
No, he never told her, but he had been abusing her, so she was leaving him.
And she had already left, but she came back.
Already left, but she went back because he said, "Oh, I just want to hold you for the last time," and he killed her.
Hmm.
Always a risk, you know. I can't make somebody not go back. All I can hope is that the information that we gave her will save her life, or that she'll hold on to it and then be able to respond like, "Okay, it's going down that road again. I need to get out." You know, think about people just in general. I want people to understand this. When someone goes back, she doesn't think in her head, he's going to kill me, or she doesn't like the abuse. Trust me, no one likes to be abused. It's because she loves him, and she might want to hold him for the last time. And unfortunately, this was her last time.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Isn't it also the case that in a situation when you leave, that you have to make up in your mind that you're leaving and for no reason go back? When you finally get the courage to leave, that you really should just make up in your mind that I'm not going to turn back, because every time you go back, aren't you putting yourself, you know, I think if I were an abuser, which I'm not, I would think that each time you left me, I'm losing my grip. So I would think each time you went back, that person, in the back of their mind, they're thinking, I'm losing my grip with this person.
Well, Carrie, I think one of the things that may have been true for the woman who just called, and I'm really sorry for your loss. I know that loss will probably be something you grieve for a long time. But what may have been true is that he was testing to see whether she was really gone for good.
Uh-huh.
These guys are really very good at manipulating. Abusers are really good at manipulating. And so he was taking this one last opportunity to see just how serious she was about leaving. And if she wasn't coming back, she wasn't leaving.
Mm.
It's like, you know, if he couldn't get her back, she was not leaving alive that last time. So I think it was in his head. And one option was that he could convince her to come back and stay, and that if she didn't, I think he had already planned to finalize that. So she may not have known that when she first got in the room with him, but it probably didn't take her long to figure out that it was a serious mistake to go back and to take this one last opportunity. I think the thing that people who are involved with abusers need to understand is that that you may be thinking from a rational place, and you may be thinking that this is possible and that we could have a relationship that has more equality to it because now I'm free and I've got my own life. But you can't ever expect that from them, so you have to not fall into the trap of thinking that they may have changed because your life does depend on that decision.
Yeah.
Another thing, too, though, I would think that probably is a good thing to remember is when you leave, you should focus on why you left and not focus on the good times, because I think sometimes when you love someone, you only want to remember the good things, and sometimes you lose focus of why you left in the first place. So wouldn't that be a good idea just to focus on why you left and keep that front and center? Because I think it's only when you're looking back on the memories, the good times, and maybe there are more good times than there are bad times, but if whatever happened caused you to get to a point that you decided you had to leave, you probably should keep that in focus. You know, the beatings. Do y'all agree with that? If it was beatings or put downs, you should always keep that in focus, front and center?
Yeah, it's just human. This is Diane. It's human nature to want to just remember the good times, but people in these situations need to remember how horrible it was when all the bad stuff was going on, and keep that front and center until they feel safe and can feel empowered. That's what our organization really, it's in our mission statement to empower these women or men to become self-sufficient and proud of who they are.
When you work with someone, though, I mean, it is good to have those, remember those things, but you also have to help her visit, you know, the good stuff. At least let her say it so it doesn't have power over her. She can romanticize the good, and then you can start working on, like, well, maybe it wasn't so good. Let's talk about how did that, you know, what changed? What happened? You know, getting her to really understand that there were things going on there that she wasn't maybe looking at, or it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't good as she thought it was. So sometimes you can't be afraid to go to that place with them and just listen and not judge her partner, because she might then want to defend her partner. So I always encourage people, just listen to her and then just focus on, well, how did that make you feel when he did that? And hopefully that helps.
Another thing, you know, in light of the Javon Belcher, Cassandra Perkins murder suicide and the shootings today, a lot of people are saying that we need stricter gun control, you know, that's the reason that all these murders and homicides are occurring. My question is, would a situation where someone's going to kill you, would stricter gun controls keep them from killing you if they really set their mind on killing you?
No.
Now, remember, this is Diana. This is this is my personal opinion, and Brandy's too. No. Gun didn't get up there and shoot somebody. I mean, that's just my personal opinion.
I think a guy mentioned last week on the show when he was talking about Javon Belcher is that, you know, again, a lot of these guys don't know how to handle their emotions. You know, I tell women this all the time, think about how you're raising your boys or men, that they need to know that there are other emotions besides anger. And that you have to control and dominate another person. They can lead by being a gentle guidance or leader. And I think that, you know, the guns, I'm not a big fan of guns. They kind of scare me, to be honest. But I mean, he could have choked her. He could have hit her. His arms were lethal. I mean, think about this guy. He probably benches her. He could take her body weight. He could have hit her and killed her. So, no, I don't, you know, that's just my opinion. I don't think the gun killed her.
Okay. And back to just before we recap, just to recap on some of the things we talked about with the I am abused, am I being abused list that we just gave you a second ago. At the bottom of this list, it says if you answer yes to even one of these, you are probably in an abusive relationship. So, again, and we listed quite a few things, y'all. If you answer yes to even one of those, it kind of says that you probably are in an abusive situation. Now, you all, let me ask you a question. Diana, Rita, Brandy, you all deal with people who are, you know, fleeing situations where the domestic violence has gotten to be too much. For someone who's never had to flee, kind of give them an indicator or just some information on what they can expect, because I think fear sometimes probably keeps some people from leaving. If they fled to, say, a brighter tomorrow, what could they expect once they got there?
Well, thanks for asking that. This is Diana. It's what we have are apartment buildings, two different apartment buildings that have been reconfigured on the inside, many of the walls taken down. There's individual bedrooms. We have rooms for maybe a mom with two or three kids. There's some areas for single women that are just there without any children. If we need to shelter a man, we have provisions to do that. There's communal kitchen. Everybody has chores. There's rules, of course, to follow, because there's generally about 30 to 35 people in the shelter per night. So there's lots of rules that need to be followed. They have to meet with their case manager every day so that they're on a good plan and they're working towards getting everything in order so that they can move into permanent safe housing. I'll let Brandy talk maybe a little bit more about the case management, but it's not a sterile dormitory style, you know, it's a home. It's a home. And really when they walk in there, I was just over the other day and I was with a detective and we walked in and he said, oh man, this is really nice. You know, we have people that adopt the rooms and paint them and decorate them. They have new bed linens. And so we really try to make it a home for them so that they feel safe and can start regenerating and working on themselves and their kids.
So, Brandy, they're not fleeing to some flea bag motel where they feel like, you know, we're just going to be getting away from, you know, one bad situation and going into an even worse situation. It's not like that. It's a home environment, right?
Yes, ma'am. It is a home environment. There's somebody on staff all the time that we have people that work through the night. So if, you know, you're sick and you need to get some fever medication, there's somebody there. When you first come in, somebody will let you eat first, take a shower if you want to, get settled in your room. There's linens laid out for them. We give them toiletries and, you know, because like we said, sometimes they leave without anything. The next day, if they come through the night, that's what happens, and through the day, they'll meet with their case manager. So this will be the person that will, like, you know, keep them in line, listen to them. And when I say keep them in line, I mean, like, keep them in direction, kind of guiding them and keeping them in focus to go to self-sufficiency because, you know, like we talked about, some of them might have never worked before. What are your goals? And everyone's goals are different, and we want them to generate their goals so that they're telling us how they see their lives and how they want, what vision they have for their life. We will set them up with counseling. I do counseling with domestic violence. We have counselors that work with the kids and a counselor that works for people who have been sexually abused and another domestic violence counselor, a great counseling staff, and we just try to, you know, embrace them.
Website or Rita's website where I saw transportation can even be provided?
Yeah, we'll transport for, like, medical appointments, counseling appointments, legal appointments. Just a side note about the legal stuff, that's another way someone can be abusive to you is through the legal system, and I'm sure Anna knows all about that. we definitely want to help them for the legal, any housing appointments. Diana, did you have something?
Well, and then we have liaisons with the school districts that we're in, and so we work really closely with them to get the kids into school and get them settled so that they can kind of get back on track and not miss school. So but we don't do everything for the women. They really need to, we encourage them to become self-sufficient as quickly as they can. They need a lot of resources, but that's what we're there for, to give them to them.
Okay. Well, y'all, that's going to have to be the final word. I'd like to say thank you to my guests, Diana Franzetti and Brandy Smith of Brighter Tomorrows here in the DFW area. Again, y'all, give them your website, and if they want to donate, how do they get to your website? That's www.brightertomorrows.net?
Yes.
Okay, www.brightertomorrows.net if you'd like to donate something to their organization. Also, we had with us tonight Rita Smith. She was with the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Their website is www.ncadv.org. And if you'd like to donate to them as well, please feel free to log on and do your part. Also, we'd like to say thank you to attorney Anna Valentini. She's with the Valentini Law Offices up in the New York area. Attorney Valentini, give them your website.
Sure. It's www.valentinilawoffices.com. Or they can just Google my name, Anna Valentini, and it will lead them to my website.
Wonderful. A reminder, y'all, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. Also, a reminder, we're looking for new advertisers here on Center Stage, so if you'd like to advertise your product or website or your business here on Center Stage, drop us a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Again, I'd like to say thank you to my guest, Diana Franzetti, Brandy Smith, Rita Smith, and attorney Anna Valentina. Also, thank you, audience, for listening. Join us here each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11. Motto here at Center Stage is less music, more talk. We're going to head out tonight, y'all, with some music from, let's just say, we're going to do some Crystal Aiken, I Need More. See you next week, y'all. Bye.
I'm warm.